Well, it's really good to see more faces here today. There's been so much crud going around that it's been a little light in attendance. Last week I gave that message, Focus on Yeshua, and all I had to focus on was one face and a camera. But anyway, I'll say Shabbat Shalom. Today we are going to have another installment in our series, part 87 at this point. Well, we're gonna work our way through the last chapter of Leviticus and finish our long journey through that book. It's interesting how the final few matters that were talked about here in the book revolve around the funding of the sanctuary. The funding of the sanctuary and the priestly ministry. And I thought it was kind of interesting that the very week that we have this installment and look at this chapter was the same week that we got a note from a couple outside of our little group this last week that said they were enjoying the messages and wanted to know how they could support the ministry. And well, the first thing I said was Venmo. Well, they didn't have that, and they didn't have Zelle, and of course they're not a family member. You know, all my kids, when they were little, I got them all a joint account at the bank, and you know, I'd be able to teach them how to manage their finances and that kind of stuff. Well, every one of the kids has kept that account, and so when they want to pay their tithes or what have you, they just text me and I transfer it from their account over into the church account. But that wouldn't work for these folks, and actually for several others that over the last year or so have inquired as well. So I decided that it was kind of past time to figure out some, you know, structured way of allowing for people to do that. So it's important, you know, our church does need funds to support the operations of, you know, we do have some expenses, but most of it goes to supporting the elderly, the fatherless, and of course, the Great Commission. So, just like us back in the day with Israel, the ministry also had need for money, not just, you know, the meat that they got from the sacrifices, but the priests had, you know, other real needs, you know. And Leviticus 27 kind of covers how some of the ways that they got actual money. Before I go there, I thought I would show you how we are doing it today. I know most of you, all of you here already know this because I sent text out, but there's folks online, of course, that are not aware of this yet. But whether you get your access to our website through, you know, a desktop computer or a mobile device, you'll notice that there's now on the menu bar, there's a donate button. And so when you click that, you get this little form here. And what's nice is you can do a one-time donation or you can do a monthly donation on a schedule. But the really cool thing I liked about this, I forget the name of the company that does this, Zephy. But anyway, they don't charge us any fees. They wouldn't charge you a fee either if you elected not to. It's kind of like that GoFundMe thing where you can decide how much you want to do, if anything at all. And the other nice thing is I get reports. It's all tracked real nice so that when I go to put it in my software stuff, I can track everybody and easily get the reports out at the end of the year. So it's specifically designed for churches and charitable organizations, and I thought it was a great way to go. There still is nothing on the website asking for donations, but the button is there now for those that are led to use it. I will say this, it's a whole lot easier than bringing in 1/10 of your goats and your sheep and your sweet corn that you grew in your garden. So there's that. Transferring those things into money makes it so that not only can the priests eat, but they can also buy some plates and stuff to eat on, right? Of course, also clothes and shelter and the other things that they require. And this is what, in a couple of ways, that Leviticus 27 deals with, right? From a biblical standpoint, a perspective of the operation of the sanctuary, what at this point in Israel's history, they had a portable tent, right? Now later it would become a fixed building, the temple. And we find that it is funded from a number of sources. And this chapter deals with several of the major categories that fund the sanctuary operations. And I'm not talking now about the sacrifices. Okay, you have pledges of silver and animals and the consecration of personal and real property like houses and land. You've got the giving of firstborn animals and the firstborn of crops and the donation of property. And of course, we get down later to actual tithing. What we read in the chapter, what we find in general, is the goal for the priesthood who operated the sanctuary, they need to obtain silver to purchase what they needed for the maintenance and operation of the sanctuary. And so therefore we will see a schedule of relative values that were drawn up for various pledges of land and animals and even people. And these things can be exchanged then for silver. So people would give an offering of something, right, to the sanctuary or to the priesthood. And then the giver would turn around and redeem it. Okay, they would buy it back and give money instead. So the question is, what was the fair value for certain items? And Yehovah provides guidance and principles for that in this chapter. Because actually the way of redeeming items was to be the norm, so that most of what the sanctuary received for its operation was money, silver, something that was easy to exchange rather than animals and crops and all that piling up. Now, they didn't have a button on a website, but they did still deal with money. Money is a subject, guys, that I have. You know this. I mean, you've never heard a message on tithing or anything else. And it's for good reason, and I've stated this. Tithes, offerings, the support of our church, and all of that is to be done from the heart. It's to be done from the heart. If someone is pressuring you and pushing you and making you feel guilty about not giving or whatever, they steal the blessing that then comes from doing it out of a loving heart. And why would I want to do that? So I haven't. Having said that, though, tithing and offerings are expressly covered in the Torah. Interestingly, it should be noted that tithing is not discussed with any detail at all in the next testament. You realize that? It is only lightly alluded to. There's like two scriptures, and then there's a couple of others, but less than on one hand, right? And in the context, it's just making a point about a Torah principle, or in two cases, kind of getting on the case of the Pharisees by Yeshua. The point is this: absolutely no command is given in the New Testament to tithe. You realize that? To tithe anything. And whatever allusion is made is in a context of a quote of the Torah. Now, some have taken this as like an out. They say, well, Yeshua never you know, recommanded it. He never talked about it. So that means that we don't have a requirement to do that. So we don't have this requirement to support the ministry anymore. Now, you won't find very many churches that subscribe to that. But yet, it's interesting, they will hold to that very same line of reasoning about the Sabbath. Because, you know, Yeshua, that's what they'll say, why are you keeping the Sabbath? Yeshua recounted all of the Ten Commandments except for that one, so why are you keeping that? Well, never mind the fact that actions speak louder than words, don't they? And Yeshua kept the Sabbath. His actions talked about the Sabbath. He wasn't trying to do away with it. Yeshua didn't come right out and say to tithe either, but they don't throw that out because they need the money. The bottom line is that the Torah that he followed and told others to follow in Matthew 5 to do likewise had not been abolished. And Yeshua said that every jot and tittle will remain intact until heaven and earth pass. The commands of God had already been established to teach the principle of tithing along with scores of other principles of wealth that we've been learning. He did not come to repeat himself. He said all this on Mount Sinai. He gave it all away. He didn't come to repeat it. He came to walk it out. The next testament is not a portion of the Bible in which everything from the previous portion, the law and the prophets, has to be recounted or repeated in order to validate it somehow. It's one of the more curious and frankly very revealing things, revealing traditions of the church to teach that the requirement to tithe is directly from that part of the Bible that it otherwise counts as obsolete and downright negative. But they hold on to that, right? They will quote Luke 11 and Matthew 23. They're very similar. Woe to you Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and all manner of herbs and pass by justice and the love of God. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. Matthew 23 says much the same way. He says that they've neglected the weightier matters of the law. And again, these you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. They'll point to where it says, these you ought to have done, referring to paying the tithes, but ignoring without leaving the others undone. Undone. What is the others? It's Torah commands. The rest of the things that God says that we are to do. Because here we have Yeshua stating straight out that not only is tithing expressly a provision of the law, but also justice and mercy and faithfulness and all the other points of the law are to be done. You should... These are things you should have done without neglecting the others. In other words, we have a complete validation of the law here. You should have done these things, and you should also do the others. And he's referring then to the ordinances of the law. So now we see why this is not really a particularly popular verse. Just like the Sabbath and so many other commands of Torah, every writer of the NT assumed the Torah. They just assumed it. You got to understand that. It was 1,300 years old by the time that Yeshua arrived on the scene physically. It was still the basis for the lifestyle of the Jewish people, of all the Hebrew people. Yeshua doesn't explain tithing because there's no need to explain it. It was just common knowledge. He also didn't command tithing because there was no need. Its requirement was already long established. Every Hebrew knew what tithing meant and understood the many forms of giving, which we're going to talk about today, not just tithing. They understood how the system operated, how the priesthood was supported, all of this, what its purpose is, and what was expected of them by God's people. It was a way of life, okay? It was just like the Shabbat, okay? He didn't have to talk about it. He walked it, okay? He didn't explain, for example, what the term law meant. He didn't need to. Everybody knew he was referring to the Torah. You know, when I say Bible, I don't need to stop and say, okay, guys, the book that has, you know, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, you know, and describe it for you. I don't have to do that. Why? Because everybody here knows what I mean when I talk about Bible, when I say that word. It's assumed. So, you know, the bottom line is they all knew this system that God had set up of giving in order to support the ministry. And as we get into the chapter, we need to realize that this is when God is giving them, they're in the wilderness. But He's looking forward to the time when, you know, they stop this nomadic lifestyle that they have and get settled into the promised land. Common sense would dictate that Israel's circumstances would be radically different once they conquered Canaan, once they had a permanent home. And this is a good example for us to note that it is the principles of the law that we need to be cognizant of rather than getting kind of bogged down into the finer details that were very cultural and very applicable at the time to their social and geopolitical, you know, situation. Okay, the chapter begins like this. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when a man consecrates by a vow certain persons to the Lord according to your valuation." So what are we talking about? We're talking about vows, giving a vow to the Lord. Most of this chapter deals with handling what is vowed. So the first time I read this chapter, I was thinking, you know, what is going on here? This is kind of weird. Well, the Hebrews made vows to God all the time, especially when they were worried or scared. It was just part of their culture. At other times when they were in a particularly, you know, pious or grateful mood, you know, they might promise God something that might be a little impulsive, okay? And very often these vows weren't particularly well thought out. They were just kind of blurted out. And they soon regretted making them. In those days, you couldn't get away with that because vows were not only public, they were made known to the priests. And everybody, okay, knew about it because vows were accompanied by certain rituals. And so after thinking about it, I thought, well, you know, this isn't really that weird. I mean, people do that today a lot, don't they? They get in some sort of a jam. They get a health problem. Their child is sick. You know, they get injured. They get in a situation where it's really dangerous. And they're like, oh, God, man, you start making deals, right? Boy, if you'll just get me out of this, if you'll just heal my daughter, if you'll just, you know, heal me, if you'll just get me out of this jam, I promise I'll do this and I'll do that. And I'll, you know, we do it. People do it. That's a vow, okay? Now, we might not think that that's a big deal. God does. God takes it as a really big deal. Because He considers at that moment, when you vow something to Him, He considers it His. And we all know that anything that is God, what is holiness? It's something that's set apart for holy use. It's something set apart for God. Well, as soon as you make that vow, It's His. It's holy. So were these folks stuck with their, you know, rashly made vows? You bet they were. You better make good on it. And you're much better off not to make the vow if you're not going to follow through with it. It's why Yeshua told us this in Matthew 5. He says, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but you shall perform your oaths to the Lord. It's a vow. But I say to you, do not swear, do not vow, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is city of the great King. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But yet your yes be yes, and your no, no, for whatever is more than these is from the evil one. In other words, don't put yourself in a place where you can't perform. Best off not to make the vow to begin with. But once you do, you are obligated to give it. Now, in some cases, as we will see as we work our way through this chapter, you could literally redeem, you could buy back your vow in certain cases for a price if that vow involved giving the Lord property that had value. Okay? Notice that a vow always includes giving God something of value. You know, God, if you'll help me, I'll do this, or I'll give you this, or I'll give somebody this, whatever it is. Okay? So even like promising to be obedient, that's a vow too, but usually in this system, that came with something of value. They would make that vow of obedience or action, but then to back that up, they would give something of worth. And typically, if the vow involved an item with a value that could be reasonably set for the redemption price, it was always 120% of that item's market value. So we're going to read that. Why? Because you're buying something back from God's. Remember, the moment you vowed it, it became His. So if you want it back, you got to redeem it. You got to buy it back. Now, why 120%? Well, I thought about this, and you think, well, now it's Yehovah's. Now it's holy. Holy things, I think, are worth more. Right? I think God says that too. Now, you could also look at it that making them pay 20% more than the market value to redeem it was God's way of teaching them, listen, don't make hasty vows. You know, it's kind of why, Yeshua said not to make them. So here in verse 1, we find that the item of value as part of the vow was a human being. Now, this was not a slave, okay? This is a case where a person offers him or herself. And what is actually being offered is that a person is offering to serve the sanctuary, serve the temple. Now, in reality, giving service to the temple was rarely even possible. Why? Because God had ordained that only the Levites and the priests could serve at the temple. An ordinary Hebrew could not. Now that's not to say that an ordinary Hebrew couldn't make a vow to work for a priest or outside of the temple. But that's not generally what happened. And that's not really, I think, what is being contemplated here in this chapter. Were there other means of entering God's service but not being attached to the temple? Of course there was. You know, we get example of like Samson and Samuel. Both had vowed to serve God in the form of a Nazarite vow, yet the form of their service did not include temple service, but rather service in different ways. You know, in their cases, judges and prophets. Since in most cases, this person who vowed himself to sanctuary service, was not going to ever be able to carry out the vow because he was restricted by regulation from doing it. In other words, he couldn't serve in the temple. What was left for him to do was to redeem the vow, right? And we see that in verses 3 through 8. If your valuation is of a male from 20 years old up to 60 years old, then your valuation shall be 50 shekels of silver, according to the shekel of the sanctuary. If it is a female, your valuation will be 30 shekels. From 5 years to 20 years old, then the valuation for a male is 20, a female 10. From a month old up to 5 years old, it's 5 shekels for a male. 3 shekels for a silver, or for 3 shekels for a female. And if from 60 years old and above, a male is 15 shekels, and a female is 10. But if he is too poor, now I'm verse 8, to pay your valuation, then he shall present himself before the priest, and the priest shall set a value for him according to the ability of him who vowed. The priest shall value him. These amounts of silver was a lot of money. I mean, we look at that and say 10 shekels, 50 shekels, whatever. Think of a shekel as 1 month's wages. So when we're talking about redeeming a male, an adult male, we're talking about 4 years, 100% of their salary, their earnings, for 4 years to redeem them. Okay? Rabbis call this chart of values the principle of equivalence. Now, we have actually seen this concept of equivalence before. We've seen it in the presentation of certain kinds of offerings to atone for certain kinds of sins, right? The greater the sin, you know, the equivalence, right? So, on the one hand, we see here that there's kind of a disparity, isn't there, between the men and the women, right? So, don't think of yourself as less, ladies. What we can take from this is that the women were allowed to make vows on their own. The children were pledged, boys and girls, for service to God by their parents. So we must never go so far as to say that Hebrew society did not value women, did not value children. Of course they did. They had rights and they had value. And the men who were, you know, in the society, had responsibilities to serve the women and the children. So that's where this kind of balance comes from. When it came to a woman's relationship with God, she could have her own personal relationship, because we can see that she can also make vows to God. She can have that direct relationship. Starting in verse 9, we move from redeeming pledged people to redeeming pledged animals. The idea was that a person could pledge an animal as part of his or her vow offering and then turn around and redeem that animal. The cost to do it, though, was 120% of the market value. Again, that extra 20% was there, in my view, either to show the value of holiness, or to, like I said, kind of teach them a lesson for being hasty in their vows. A logical question to ask would be, so who sets the market valuation? Who sets the value for the animals? Well, the priesthood. In many ways, this represents tremendous power being vested in the priesthood. After all, you know, whatever the priest decided was the proper valuation for an animal was not going to be any different than what the valuation was in the marketplace, right? So this gave really the priesthood a lot of power, because there wouldn't have been one value for it being offered up to the priest, and another value in a, just an ordinary transaction. The priests were administrators of justice and actually had a hand in setting the market price for animals along with their temple duties. Moving to 9 and 10, it says, if an animal that men may bring as an offering to the Lord, all that anyone gives to the Lord shall be holy. It goes back to what I was saying. He shall not substitute it or exchange it, good for bad or bad for good. And if he at all exchanges animal for animal, then both it and the one exchanged for it shall be holy. What's it saying? Well, we're dealing now not with a vow. Notice that it says that men may bring as an offering. Okay? So a vow is saying this is something that will be given. An offering is they come and they give the and they're going to give this offering. And it says that it cannot be redeemed at that point. And because it's done. It's already done. It belongs to the Lord. And in this case of an offering, it can't be redeemed. And if you tried to do that, it would be violating God's holy property, and it's actually a penalty for death. A person who designates an animal for sacrifice as part of a vow can't later substitute it for a different animal, as it says, even if that animal is of a greater value and greater worth. Say, well, I'm gonna change this out and I'm gonna give you a better one. Or I want to keep this better one, I want to give you this one with a gimpy leg. Right? You can't do that. As soon as you do that, God says, well, look, you gave me the first one, that one's holy. You can have it. Now you want to trade it for this one over here, so you want to give me that one too. So I'm keeping them both. That's basically what he's saying. Why is that? Because, again, it's holy. And once it's given over, you know, then they are both his property. That should give you a twinge in there somewhere. Because you read this and you think, oh man, I got to be careful. I need to be careful about how I engage in this relationship with God and handling my resources and what I pledge, vow, offer, whatever word whatever section this is, whether it's an offering, a vow, tithes, whatever. God is serious about how we manage our money, especially when it involves our financial affairs towards Him. Get it? Let's keep going. The first animal discussed, since it was suitable for altar sacrifice, was by definition clean animals. Verse 11 addresses unclean animals. If it is an unclean animal, which they do not offer as a sacrifice to the Lord, you can't offer a sacrifice of an unclean animal, then he shall present the animal before the priest. And the priest shall set a value for it, whether it be good or bad. As you, the priest, value it, so it shall be. So they get to set the value. But if he wants at all to redeem it, then he must add 1/5 to your valuation. So we have an unclean animal. And you want to give this animal. Now this is not for sacrifices, okay? So it's an unclean animal. You know, I've got 10 camels. Okay, I got 20 camels, and I want to give a camel. You know, maybe the priest didn't need the camel. So he gives him a camel. All right. It's perfectly acceptable. You can give God that. All right? But it also automatically means that the animal has to be exchanged for money. Why? Because what else is the priest going to do with it? It can't be sacrificed. It can't be brought into the sanctuary, the temple. The priest can't eat it. Okay? So it's got to be redeemed. It's got to be turned into money. As you move to verse 14, things shift then to inanimate objects, things of value. When a man dedicates his house to be holy to the Lord, then the priest shall set a value for it. Whether it be good or bad, as the priest values it, so it shall stand. First thing to notice is that the verbiage has changed now from a vow to this dedication or consecration. Now, these are things that are set apart for God, not necessarily as part of a vow, but perhaps more as like a free will offering, okay, or a gift. But again, if somebody says, you know, on the spur of the moment, you know, here's my house, I'm going to, you know, well, if he wants it back, he's got to redeem it at 120%, okay? And the next thing that we see is if someone consecrates land. Now, just like if the land was sold to another person, how is land valued? We talked about this in the Jubilee. You can't sell it, right? Because it always reverts back. So what's the value of the land? The value of the land is what it's going to produce from that point to Jubilee. All right? So that's how that is done. But then again, to redeem it, it's 120% of that. And in these verses, we get, I'm not going to read them all, from verses 15 down to verse 24, he even gives the value of barley and different things so that those numbers can be set. We don't have to really read through all that. We're very familiar with how the how that works in terms of the Jubilee and understanding that the value is worth what the land will produce. So after that, after verse 24, we get this really interesting, kind of seems like almost a footnote in verse 25. It says, "And all your valuations shall be according to the shekel of the sanctuary, 20 gerahs, I guess, to the shekel." So what's going on here? God sets a standard for the shekel, and it's called the sanctuary shekel. A sanctuary shekel, we know, is two things. It was silver, and its weight was 20 gerahs. Okay? It's a precise weight. Now, why did he have to do this? It's because at that time, anybody could and did mint their own coins in those days. And they, when they did that, they would determine what the coin's weight was going to be, what it was made out of. The very first coins that were used for money were basically, you know, you'd take a little bit of silver and you'd melt it down, and while it was still hot and pliable, you'd take your signet ring and smush it into the silver. Okay? Kings and rulers had signet rings, and they would make their money. And when they made their money, they could make it with, you know, 15 grains of silver, or 20 or 18, or, you know, whatever they wanted to make, right? But God set a standard for the sanctuary. So what would happen, you know, what would happen is that people would come to the tabernacle, they want to pay their redemption price. And who knows what they would have. They'd have a handful of coins and, you know, blobs of silver or whatever, and the priest would take it and he would weigh it. And so a shekel was 20, I'm going to say grains, or 20 gerahs. And that's how it was computed. Now, many years later, the first temple, Solomon's temple, the priests actually minted temple coins. And so by the second temple period in Yeshua's day, the entire priest and temple institution had become corrupt. You know, the only way, they made it to where the only way you could pay a redemption price or to purchase a sacrificial animal was with coins that were minted by the temple. So the Jews would come from all over the Roman Empire with perfectly valid coins from whatever wherever they came from, and they were forced then to exchange that money for the temple coins. Okay? And you remember the story about Yeshua and the money changers and him coming in and flipping the tables and getting upset. Why? Because they were, what they would do is they would bring in the money. They made a rule that you had to use these coins. Not just 20 shekels of silver. No, that had to be 20 of our shekels. So you got to exchange that. And of course, we're going to charge you a fee to do it. And so it became very corrupt, right? This really makes you understand that it was a nasty business. And that Yeshua was very, very right in flipping them over and exposing what they were doing. Money, the Bible says, is a root of evil, so we need to be careful. Starting in verse 26, we get this idea of the firstlings. But the firstborn of the animals, which should be the Lord's firstborn, no man shall dedicate, because it's already done. Whether it is an ox or sheep, it is the Lord's. It's already the Lord's. And if it is an unclean animal, then he shall redeem it, like we talked about, according to your valuation, and shall add one-fifth to it. Or if it's not redeemed, then it shall be sold according to your valuation. What you see here is that since all firstfruits or firstborns of animals or people, they belong to God by default. So they can't be consecrated, they can't be offered. You can't give to the Lord something that He already has, as though it's some additional offering. And this was the case with tithing, for example. The first 10% is already Yehovah's. You don't give it to Him. You don't dedicate it to Him. You don't vow it to Him. It's already His. Now, I kind of view this as a partnership. You see, Yehovah provides me life, provides me breath, provides me the energy, provides me the knowledge and the wisdom, all of the natural resources, every single thing I use and need to make an increase. He provides it. He's my partner. And for that, what does my partner get? He provides everything. And he says, I've reserved 10% for myself. That is a pretty good deal. I don't give it to him. It's already his for what he has provided in order to make the increase. So the firstborn is always his. Clean things. Things that have been declared ritually clean and suitable for sacrifice before Yehovah are provided. When we talk about unclean things, like animals, they can be consecrated to the Lord, but they must be redeemed. And then the money given in its stead. And again, that price is 20% if you want to redeem it. It's market value if you give it and the priest sells it to somebody else. And so one has to kind of think about this and wonder, why in the world would someone go through this strange process of giving something and then knowing that he'd have to turn around and redeem it for 20% more? Well, they didn't do it on purpose, you know, it's just situational, right? A person might give an animal because he currently has no money, yet he owes a vow or something, right? So it's agreed then that the animal is held for a time until the person can come up with the money to redeem it. There are a lot of principles here, guys, that we need to understand. I know and I recognize the fact that this seems disjointed from us, animals and all of this, but you've got to look past that and understand what God is doing here and how He views our relationship of using His resources and all of this. Verse 28 describes another kind of setting apart an item for God. It says, "Nevertheless, no devoted offering." This is kind of interesting language here. "No devoted offering that a man may devote to the Lord of all that he has, both man and beast, or the field of his possession, shall be sold or redeemed. Every devoted offering is most holy to the Lord." Now, different Bibles use different words for this particular kind of giving. Some say devote, some will say prescribe, others state clearly that it's consecrated unconditionally. What this is getting at is this particular type of setting apart an item for God, there can be no redemption. It is a permanent consecration. Notice that it says nevertheless. So what that means is, notwithstanding everything I've already told you, with this particular type of offering, there is no redemption. There is no buying it back. It's permanent. And I don't want to get bogged down. We're going to run out of time with going through these terms for each kind of offering, like a vow and consecrations and, you know, devote or prescribe and all that kind of thing. What we need to understand is the important principle that there are a number of kinds of classes or giving of things to God, of setting things apart for God. And each has its own rules and its own regulations. All these things, these various situations, lend toward the realization that if we mechanically, you know, push aside the 10% of our income to God, well, we're all good. I'm all good now. And I can go and I can see somebody in need and I can look away. Because, you know, I've already given, right? Well, no, you haven't. You haven't given anything. It was always God's. You see, you don't see that in the Bible. You see commands that teach you that certain things are already God's. You can't give God something that's already His. You're not giving it to Him. All you're doing is being obedient. And then from there, what we're seeing is all these different classes of giving. So yes, there's giving, but then there's also just obedience of understanding what is already God's. And a big lesson in this chapter is to make 100% sure that what you utter to God in a vow is carried out. Because like Yeshua said, it's better not to vow at all if you're not going to keep it. Let your yes be yes. In other words, don't say in the future, "I will do such and such." Like the Nike saying, just go ahead and do it. Just do it. Don't put yourself in a position that you can't perform later. Realize that 10% is not the final and rigid number for us. Not really. Not in terms of giving. The tithe only represents one certain kind of financial thing here. Not the sum total of all the giving that we are to do. The next verse at first seems out of place, but it's not. Verse 29 says, "No person under the ban who may become doomed to destruction among men shall be redeemed, but shall be surely put to death." What's going on here is that no person who has been given the death penalty for some capital offense of Torah can be redeemed for money. He must die. He's saying you can't take what I just said, you know, 50 shekels of silver for this age and that whatever, and use that to redeem this person that has been deserving of death. Because what Yeshua has done here is he's become full circle. We've been going along kind of speaking about devoting or setting aside things to God, gifts, offerings, vows, all these positive things. And then scripture just throws in someone who's committed a capital offense, a bad thing, a negative thing, right? And tries to put that in the same category. What is being demonstrated here is that there is a connection between a person violating a very serious law of God. You've got to get this. That this connection, somebody is violating this very serious law of God, earning the death penalty, right alongside setting aside things for God. And follow this, because we need to see how God and the Hebrew system views justice. In chapter 26, what we saw was God makes a law, a regulation, and He sets down a blessing for that when it's observed, and He sets down a consequence when it's not, right? Just good, you know, child rearing. We're the children, okay? The consequence for the violation of some of God's laws is physical death. This is not a human determination. This is not a group of lawmakers sitting around, you know, arguing their morality and determining who must die. This is God's determination as given to Moses and set down in the Torah. When God demands the life of the violator, that life belongs to God. Okay? It is bound up in the same principle that when a sheep or a bull or goat or whatever is set apart for sacrifice, the life of that animal is God's at that moment. When in the administration of justice, the person who has allegedly violated God's law is found guilty, it is the judge's duty to put on to that person the judgment that God declared for that person. The judge has no right to do anything else, regardless of his personal decisions or feelings of morality or whatever. He is to execute the law. Okay? And if not, then he's disobeying God. So it's not man who says you must die for committing murder. It's God that's saying it. Man is just being obedient when he, according to God's commands, executes a murderer. A person who is to be killed for violating God's law is, in God's eyes, already set apart for him in the sense that God is going to take back the life that he has given that person. All life is the Lord's. This is why we have the Hebrew thought that a man who violates a capital crime and receives capital punishment is atoning for his own sins. You know, we've covered that. You know, the animal, you know, sits in place of the man in the sacrificial system. For us, it was Yeshua. And that is why Yeshua said, when we accept his sacrifice, that we are bought with a price. This is in 1 Corinthians 6:20. I put it on the screen for you. The principle being that whatever is set apart for God, whether it be the result of something positive or negative, it's God's. It is His. And whatever is His is holy. And you don't mess with God's holy property. Okay. Finally, now we come to the actual tithe. Verse 30, and all the tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land or of the fruit of the tree, is the Lord's. It is holy to the Lord. If a man wants at all to redeem any of his tithes, he shall add one-fifth to it. And concerning the tithe of the herd or of the flock, of whatever passes under the rod, the tenth one shall be holy to the Lord. And he shall not inquire whether it is good or bad, nor shall he exchange it. And if he exchanges it all, then both it and the one exchanged for it shall be holy. It shall not be redeemed. So again, you know, you can't change your mind. These verses speak of two types of tithes, a tenth of the crops from the land and a tenth of the increase of the animals. Understand that all of these different types of giving apply to an Israelite's life simultaneously. He doesn't choose from a menu or a list of options for giving, and then they each apply according to the circumstance. Here, a tithe is just an automatic tenth of your increase, whatever form that increase might be, doesn't matter. And this is, guys, it's in addition to all the other types. Well, it's in addition to giving. So you've got tithe, which really isn't giving, and then you've got giving. And since there was tithes, you know, it's usually, you know, they were given in the form of animals or produce, they could redeem that, right? So if they wanted that back, they could do the 120%, but the priest could take and sell it at market value, okay? One thing to notice is in this, you know, in other places we are told in the sacrifices that it is to be the best. So if you have 10 sheep, you go pick out the best one. With the tithe, it wasn't that way. Like it says, whether it is good or bad, it's a tenth. And it's supposed to be representative of the whole, right? So like if you got 10 really good sheep and 10 really bad sheep, and one kind of mediocre sheep, you give the mediocre sheep. You know, it's supposed to be representative of your increase. All right, I want to try to sum this up, okay, and bring this around to principles that we can take away with us. Chapter 27 revolves around vows and commitments that someone has made to Yehovah. But in general, Yehovah is not looking, he's not seeking our vows. Hence, Yeshua's instruction, hey, it's better not to vow at all, okay? Because then you could mess up and not do it. God takes these things seriously. So changing one's mind is very costly. 20%, right? Vows are not to be taken lightly. There is a major downside to making future vows to God, particularly if you're not very good at following through. We are to understand that all we have comes from God. Our ability, our life and energy, the wisdom to take resources that He's provided and create an increase with it, all that comes from God. So it is only fair and natural that God reserves a portion of that increase that He has participated in creating. You know, there's a verse, I forget where it is, Malachi maybe? I don't remember. But it basically says that what God sends out is not to return to Him void. Okay? So He's provided all of this stuff that we use to create an increase, and so that is not to return to Him void. So there is a portion of your increase, the lesson is, that is not yours to start with. It's not yours. It's to just flow back to Him. You know, from there comes our giving, our offerings, things that we set aside for God because it's in our heart to be thankful, grateful for what God has done. To help the elderly, to help the fatherless, to see people in need, to preach the gospel, to support the ministry, all of these things, okay? Things that we set aside for God because it's in our heart. This is separate, okay? In one way, you're just giving, you're not giving. You're flowing back to God that which is His. The other things are giving from a grateful heart. In 2 Corinthians 9:7, it says, let each one give as he purposes in his heart, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver. Yehovah is the ultimate giver. Our destiny is to reflect Him. Giving is one of His attributes that we are to emulate. And He promises to bless that attitude. Malachi 3 says to bring all the tithes into the storehouse that there may be food in my house, and try me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such blessings that there will not be room enough to receive it. Of this he talks about tithes, which are his to begin with. How much more does this apply to actual giving? This is going to be about as much as you'll probably hear from me on the subject of money and tithing and supporting the work and all of that kind of stuff. I want to leave it alone because I want people to understand and build their own relationship with God, be grateful for what God is doing in their lives, to understand the principle of tithing, that it's really not yours, you're not really giving it to them, and then go beyond that and be people that give. And that, you know, and you're not going to legislate that. You can't legislate the heart for people, right? So we come to the end of Leviticus with Yehovah's final statement. These, all, everything we've learned in the, I don't know how many, in many parts that we've covered Leviticus. These are the commands which the Lord commanded Moses for the children of Israel on Mount Sinai. Amen? Amen.